On a Tuesday in April of 2005, Linus Torvalds is pacing in his home office in Portland, Oregon. The room is small. A desk against one wall, a window that looks out into a back garden, a few photographs of the family pinned to a corkboard near the door. On the desk, a laptop, open, with several terminal windows visible on screen. The blinds are half drawn against the afternoon sun. The house is quiet, the way a house is quiet when the children are at school and the spouse is at work, and the only sound is the small mechanical hum of the laptop fan, and just barely the noise of a single man walking the length of his office and back, again and again, thinking. He has just gotten news. The company called Bitmover, the company that makes the version control software that Linux has been using for 3 years, is revoking the free license that the Linux kernel has depended on. The reason is bureaucratic and a little sad. An Australian engineer named Andrew Trigil, who built two beloved pieces of free software called Samba and RSYNC, has been trying to reverse engineer the BitKeeper protocol. The chief executive of Bitmover, a man named Larry McVoy, has decided he has had enough. Effective shortly, Linux can no longer use the tool. This is, for Linus, a serious problem. Linux, at this point, is the largest open source project in the world. Thousands of developers scattered across every continent and every time zone are working on it daily. Every change they propose, every line they edit, every conflict they resolve flows through the version control software that in roughly 2 weeks will no longer be available to them. There is no obvious replacement. The other tools in the field are, by his own famously blunt judgment, not good enough. He has spent 12 years building the largest collaborative piece of software in history, and he is about to lose the spine that holds the collaboration together. He shuts the door of the office. He sits down at the desk. He starts writing. 3 days later, he has a working prototype of what he is calling Git, a piece of British slang for an unpleasant person, named, with characteristic self-deprecation, after himself. The first commit message in the history of the tool reads, in its entirety, initial revision of Git, the information manager from hell. This is Rust, gently, a patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 20, The Social Act of Programming. Today, I want to take you inside the strange and beautiful machinery that lets thousands of strangers collaborate on the same piece of software without ever meeting, without ever speaking, often without ever knowing each other's names. By the end of this episode, you will understand what version control is, where it came from, why Git in particular changed the shape of the industry, and how the open source culture that surrounds it has come to define the way nearly all software, including Rust, is built today. Let me back up and explain why this matters in the first place. If you and three colleagues are writing a novel together, and each of you has a copy of the manuscript on your own laptop, and each of you is editing simultaneously, you will run into trouble within an afternoon. You change a sentence on page 40. Your colleague, at the same moment, replaces the whole paragraph on page 40. A third colleague rewrites the chapter title. When the three of you try to combine your work in the evening, you will spend hours sorting out who changed what and which version to keep and what was lost. Now, imagine the manuscript has 500 chapters instead of 15 pages. Now, imagine there are not three colleagues, but 3,000. Now, imagine they're spread across every time zone in the world, and they will never all be awake at the same time. That is, more or less, the problem of building a large piece of software. The solution, called version control, is a piece of software that keeps a complete history of every change to every file by every person, with a timestamp and a written explanation. It can rewind to any moment in the past. It can let two people work on the same file at the same time and combine their changes automatically when those changes do not actually conflict. It can let a person try a wild experimental idea on a side branch, decide they hate it, throw it away, and return to the main trunk as if nothing had happened. The first version control tools, in the early 1970s were extremely simple. A man named Mark Rochkind at Bell Labs wrote one called SCCS in 1972. It managed one file at a time. There was almost no notion of branching. A decade later, a man named Walter Tichy at Purdue wrote one called RCS, slightly better, still one file at a time, with a checkout and lock model. If you wanted to edit a file, you had to lock it, and nobody else could touch it until you were done. Like one person standing in front of a single typewriter while everyone else waited their turn. Through the 1980s and 90s, a series of incremental improvements followed. CVS, which finally let multiple people edit the same file at once and worked out the conflicts on commit. Then Subversion in the year 2000, which fixed several of the rough edges of CVS and dominated the industry through most of the 2000s. All of these systems shared a property called centralized. There is a single server somewhere holding the official history, and every change had to flow through that server. If the server was down, nobody could commit. If the server was slow, everybody waited. If the company that ran the server lost the data, the project lost its history. Around 1998, a man named Larry McVoy, the same one who would later make the famous phone call in 2005, started building a tool called BitKeeper, which broke that pattern. BitKeeper was distributed, which meant every developer's laptop held a complete copy of the entire history of the project. You could work on a transatlantic flight with no internet at all and still make commits, branch, rewind. When you reconnected to the network, you would push your commits up to a colleague who would integrate them on their own copy. There was still, in practice, a central repository, but it was a social convention, not a technical requirement. Linux adopted BitKeeper in 2002. The free software community, who did not like depending on a proprietary tool, complained loudly. Linus, who cared more about engineering quality than ideology, used it anyway until the spring of 2005. When a license was pulled, Linus had 2 weeks to build something better. The thing he built, Git, was distributed like BitKeeper, but it was also extraordinarily fast and had a model of storing the history that was mathematically more elegant than anything before it. By April 7th, just a few days after he sat down, the first version was working. By April 18th, Git was capable of hosting its own development, which is the moment a piece of software stops being a sketch and becomes a real tool. By June, the Linux kernel, version 2.6.12, shipped with its history managed in Git. 10 weeks. Written in C with some shell, scripting glued on top. Now here is the part that turned out to matter most. Within a decade of being written, Git had become the default version control system for essentially every piece of software on Earth. By 2020, the question for any new project was no longer which version control system to use. The question was, what kind of Git hosting do you prefer? The most important answer to that question is called GitHub. GitHub was founded on April 10th of 2008 in San Francisco by four engineers named Tom Preston-Werner, Chris Wanstrath, PJ Hyatt, and Scott Chacon. What they did was wrap Git in a beautiful web interface and then add two cultural innovations that would change what it means to work in software. The first was the public profile. Every commit you made was visible. Your contributions, over time, became a public record, a resume of sorts. The second was something called the pull request, often abbreviated to PR. Instead of emailing a patch to a mailing list and hoping for a response, you clicked a button and a structured page appeared, with a diff in green and red, and a discussion thread underneath. Other engineers could comment on individual lines of code. Automated tests could run against your branch and report back on the same page. The change could be approved, requested for revisions, or rejected, all in one place. Before GitHub, contributing to an open source project was a high friction act. You had to know the conventions of the mailing list, format your patch correctly, write a polite email, and wait, sometimes for weeks, for a reply. After GitHub, you could do all of it from a browser. A 13-year-old with a laptop an internet connection, and patients could read the source of a major open source project, find a small mistake, propose a change, and see that change merged into the system with their name on it forever. The pull request was a culture-shaping invention. By 2018, GitHub had roughly 28 million developers. Microsoft bought it for $7.5 billion in stock that June. By 2024, the number was past 100 million, which is more than the population of every country except 13. It is worth pausing for a moment on what that number really means. 100 million people scattered across every populated continent, contributing in some way to a shared body of work. Some of them are professional engineers at the largest companies in the world. Some of them are students. Some of them are retirees writing their first program at the age of 70. Some of them are working in their second language. They have never met. Most of them never will. And yet, in a meaningful sense, they are coworkers exchanging artifacts the way coworkers do through a tool that one slightly frustrated man wrote in a fortnight in 2005. There's a small command called git blame that captures something else about this world. If you point git blame at any source file in any project, it will tell you, for every single line in that file, who wrote it, when, and what they said in the commit message at the time. Every line is traceable to a name and a moment. There's a forensic flavor to this, and there is a cultural flavor too. Every line you ship in your software career is searchable by every engineer who comes after you. There's a kind of accountability built into the tool itself. There's also a kind of shared inheritance, because reading old git blame output is reading what the people who came before you were thinking when they made the choices they did. You can sit down with a piece of code that confuses you, run git blame, and find that the line that has been giving you trouble was written 9 years ago by an engineer named Yuki in Tokyo, who wrote in the commit message a one-sentence note explaining that this particular workaround was needed because of a hardware quirk on a model of network card that no longer exists. The note remains. The hardware is gone. The line, until somebody chooses to clean it up, lives on. In production, this is what runs nearly all serious software. Every line of the Linux kernel, of the Rust compiler, of Kubernetes, of React, of Firefox, every change to every database that runs every bank and every hospital you can name was proposed through some variant of this workflow. A diff, a description, a review, a merge. Some kids start contributing to open source at 13 and watch their merged pull requests pile up the way other kids watch their high score on a video game. The Rust project itself lives on GitHub at a public address that anyone can browse, and many of the most consequential changes to the language began as pull requests from people the core team had never met. The compiler error messages we talked about last time, the most pedagogically generous error messages in the history of the field, are themselves the work of dozens of strangers proposing patches, line by line, over a decade, through this same workflow. Three things to carry from today. First, software is collaborative on a scale that almost no other craft is. Thousands of strangers across time zones share a single artifact, and the tool that lets them do it is called version control. Second, the dominant version control tool, called Git, was written by one man in 2 weeks in his home office in Portland in the spring of 2005 in response to a vendor's decision he could not control. Third, the cultural innovation that turned Git into the entire industry spine, the pull request, made it possible for anyone, anywhere, to propose a change to even the largest software in the world simply by reading the source and writing a careful diff. Next time on Rust, gently, we will talk about the economics of software that gets given away. Why companies pay engineers full-time to build code they immediately release to the world for free. Why Linux runs 95% of cloud servers and earns its writers nothing directly. And what the four freedoms, written down by one stubborn man in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1983, have to do with the language this show is named after. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.